cut to Abe Lincoln by the fireplace in a log house. An American, Francis Grund remarked in 1837, is almost from his cradle brought up to reflect on his condition, and from the time he is able to act, employed with the means of improving it. Lincoln, hardly a slouch as writer, speaker, or thinker, packed 50 weeks of formal schooling into his entire life over the 12-year period between 1814 and 1826. Even that little seemed a waste of time to his relatives. Unless you wanted to argue that those few weeks made a decisive difference to Abe, we need to look elsewhere for his education. Clifton Johnson thinks it happened this way. He acquired much of his early education at home. In the evening, he would pile sticks of dry wood into the brick fireplace. These would blaze up brightly and shed a strong light over the room. The boy would lie down flat on the floor before the hearth with his book in front of him. He used to write his arithmetic sums on a large wooden shovel with a piece of charcoal. After covering it all over with examples, he would take his jackknife and whittle and scrape the surface clean, ready for more ciphering. Paper was expensive, and he could not afford a slate. Sometimes, when the shovel was not at hand, he did his figuring on the logs of the house walls and on the doorposts, and other woodwork that afforded a surface he could mark with his charcoal. In Lincoln's Illinois and Kentucky, only reading, writing, and ciphering to the rule of three were required of teachers. But in New England, the business often attracted ambitious young men like Noah Webster, confident and energetic, merely pausing on their way to greater things. Adam Gorowski, mid-19th century traveler in our land, took special notice of the superiority of American teachers. Their European brethren were, he said, withered drifters or narrowed martinets. Young people in America were expected to make something of themselves, not to prepare themselves to fit into a pre-established hierarchy. Every foreign commentator notes the early training in independence, the remarkable precocity of American youth, their assumption of adult responsibility. In his memoir, Tom Nichols, a New Hampshire schoolboy in the 1820s, recalls the electrifying air of expectation in early American schools. Our teachers constantly stimulated us by glittering prizes of wealth, honors, offices, and distinctions, which were certainly within our reach. There were 100 avenues to wealth and fame opening fair before us if we only chose to learn our lessons. Overproduction, overcapacity would have been an alien concept to that America, something redolent of British mercantilism. Our virgin soil and forests undermined the stern doctrine of Calvinism by paying dividends to anyone willing to work. As Calvinism waned, contrarian attitudes emerged which represented a new American religion. First, the conviction that opportunity was available to all. Second, that failure was the result of deficient character, not predestination or bad placement on a biological bell curve. Character flaws could be remedied, but only from the inside. You had to do it yourself through courage, determination, honesty, and hard work. Don't discount this as hot air. It marks a critical difference between Americans and everyone else. Teachers had a place in this process of self-creation, but it was an ambiguous one. Anyone could teach, it was thought, just as anyone could self-teach. Secular schools, always a peripheral institution, were viewed with ambivalence, although teachers were granted some value, if only gratitude, for giving mother a break. In the southern and middle colonies, teachers were often convicts serving out their sentences. Their place in the social order, caught in this advertisement of Washington's day. Ran away, a servant who followed the occupation of schoolmaster, much given to drinking and gambling. Washington's own schoolmaster, Hobby, was just such a bondsman. Traditional lore has it that he laid the foundation for national greatness by whipping the devil out of Washington. Whipping and humiliation seem to have always been an eternal staple of schooling. Evidence survives from ancient Rome, Montaigne's France, Washington's Virginia, or my own high school in western Pennsylvania in the 1950s, where the teacher's personalized paddle hung prominently at the entrance to many a classroom, not for decoration, but for use. The football coach, and if I recall correctly, the algebra teacher, customized their paddles, using a dry cell battery to fashion devices similar to electrified cattle prods. Something in the structure of schooling calls forth violence. While latter-day schools don't allow energetic physical discipline, certainly they are state-of-the-art laboratories in humiliation, as your own experience should remind you. In my first years of teaching, I was told over and over that humiliation was my best friend, more effective than whipping. I witnessed this theory in practice through my time as a teacher. If you were to ask me whether physical or psychological violence does more damage, I would reply that slurs, aspersion, formal ranking, insult, and inference are far and away more deadly. Nor does law protect the tongue-lashed. Early schools in America were quick with cuff or cane, but local standards demanded fairness. Despotic teachers were often quarry themselves, as Washington Irving's Legend of Sleepy Hollow warns us. Listen to the fate of schoolmaster Thomas Beveridge at the hands of the upper-class Latin school in Philadelphia, 11 years before the Revolution. He arrives, enters the school, and is permitted to proceed until he is supposed to have nearly reached his chair at the upper end of the room, when instantly the door and every window shutter is closed, now shrouded in utter darkness. The most hideous yells that can be conceived are sent forth from 70 of throats. And Ovid's and Virgil's and Horace's, together with the more heavy metal of dictionaries, are hurled without remorse at the astonished preceptor, who, groping and crawling under cover of the forms, makes the best of his way to the door. When attained, a light is restored, and a death-like silence ensues. Every boy is at his lesson. No one had a hand or voice in the recent atrocity. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In the humbler setting of rural Indiana, recreated by Eggleston for Hoosier Schoolmaster, published in 1871, we can easily see that passage of more than a century and the replacement of rich kids by farmers' sons and daughters hasn't altered classroom dynamics. When Ralph looked round the faces of the scholars, the little faces full of mischief and curiosity, the big faces full of an expression which was not further removed than second cousin from contempt, when young Hartsook looked at these faces, his heart palpitated with stage fright. There is no audience so hard to face as one of school children, as many a man has found to his cost. While Ralph was applying to a trustee of the school committee for his job, a large ugly bulldog sniffed at his heels, causing a young girl to nearly giggle her head off at the delightful prospect of seeing a new school teacher eaten up by the ferocious brute. Weary, discouraged, shivering with fear, he is lectured. "You see, we ain't none of your soft sort in these diggins. It takes a man to boss this deestrict. If you get licked, don't come to us. Flat crick don't pay no insurance, you bet. It takes grit to apply for this school. The last master had a black eye for a month."